I want us to go and look here at Revelation chapter 8. Again, we're going to take a look at a few things. We're going to set the groundwork in regard to the trumpets. As I mentioned to you, the trumpets are divided up, the first four and then the last three. But even in the last three, they're divided into two parts, the five and six, and then the seventh standing by itself, only because of the historic application. Now, as I told you before, what I want to do is kind of give an overview, a general picture of what is taking place here. I'm not going to be able to go through every little detail. One, I don't know every little detail. And second of all, it's just so time-consuming in terms of the historical fulfillment of everything that took place. There's an awful lot of history. You know, some wonders, I know I do. You know, I thought, Lord, why all this history? Why? You know, you look at, for example, Daniel 11. There's a lot of history. Daniel chapter 7, a lot of history. Revelation 13, the seven churches, seven seals. We're talking a lot of history. And I've often thought, you know, why, Lord? Why you give us so much of this? And I'll tell you why. Look, let me show you something. Keep your finger there. Go with me now to the book of Ecclesiastes. And I'm going to show you something that I think is very important in the light of that. Why? Why all this history? Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 15. Now watch what it says. That which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been. And God requires that which is past. Now think of that. That which hath been is now, that which is to be hath already been. Now it sounds contradicting. It sounds like this makes no sense. Now, on the surface, it sounds like a dichotomy. It's a contradiction. But it's not. That which hath been is now, that which is to be hath already been. First of all, let's break this down. That which hath been. Past, present, or future. It's the past tense. So we have another way of calling the past what? History. Isn't that right? Sure. All right, listen to me. That which hath been is now. That's what? Present tense. Isn't that right? Now is now. All right, listen to me. How can something in the past be now? Then he goes on to say, that which is to be, that's in the future, hath already been. How can something in the future already be in the past? How can something in the past be now? That's exactly what it is. History repeats itself. That's why it gives us so much history. Look at the Great Controversy. Look at that book. Do you realize that more than three quarters of that book is simply history? And yet it's a book for the end time? And more than three quarters of it is simply purely history. Probably 80%+ of that book is history. Why? Unless those historical events have a significance in regard to what's going to take place at the end of time. Either the issues themselves that are dealing with it, or the events themselves depicting maybe a parallel to what is going to take place at the end of time. Why does God give us so much history? Because it's a lesson for us in the present. Look what it says, and God requires that which is past. God requires what? That we study history. So there is a reason. There is a reason. And I think that when we look at the trumpets, there is a reason why these things are so. So history is important. It plays a significant role for God's people in understanding the events that take place now and in the future. I think this will be the case as well when we look at the trumpets, because we're going to see some things that will, again, culminate within the seventh. Now, let's take a moment here. Before we get into each trumpet and what they signify, I want to break it down a little bit here. Historically speaking, we know these are judgments. We understand that. We know from the context from Revelation 8, 3 through 5, that for someone or a nation or a group of people, probation has closed. There's no doubt. Mediation has ceased. Judgment's going to follow now. Question is who? And the issues would come and why? You know, why would judgment fall on them? Why did they reject God? What was the point? All right, now look. One thing I want to show you in Revelation chapter 8, verse 7. Look with me here. The first angel sounded, and there followed hail with fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth. Stop right there. We know that these judgments fall upon where? The earth. All right, now look, let's stop here for a moment. This is talking about the world. But the only problem we have here, it's not the world in the sense that we think of the whole world, of every single person in the world. So we have to look at Revelation in the light of Daniel, don't we? In other words, to understand some of the things in the book of Revelation, don't we have to go to Daniel? Of course we do. Remember, what is Daniel? Daniel's the prophecy. What is Revelation? But the revelation of the book of Daniel. It's an unfolding. Remember, they are mere complements of each other. You have to study them together. Now look, when we look at world empires, we understand that according to Daniel 2, Daniel 7, even parts of Daniel 8, Daniel 11, we understand Revelation 13, We know that these world powers, and I speak of the then known world at that time, can only exist within four powers: Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and pagan Rome. In other words, these judgments that are falling have to fall upon the earth, as it says, meaning the then known world at that time. The question is, which of the four does it fall upon? That's what you have to look at. This is clearly indicating probation closing for the then known world. And by the way, that's a beautiful parallel for the seventh trumpet, because probation will eventually close for the entire world. You see, you have that parallel historical, future, history repeating itself. Instead of pagan Rome, then it's Babylonian Rome, right? Historically speaking, I mean, in terms of then the future. Look, let me show you something about the power that I believe that the trumpets are referring to, at least the first six. Go to Revelation chapter 8, and I want to read you something here I think you want to look to, and I thank God for helping me to understand this. Revelation chapter 8, verse 7, and I want to show you this. It says, "The first angel sounded, and there followed hail, fire, mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth, and a third part of the grass was burnt up, and all the trees, a green grass, was burnt up." Now, a third part of the trees. Did you catch it? A third part of the trees. All of them wondering, why only a third? You know, why not two-thirds? Why not half? Why not 75%? Whatever. Right? A third. All right, now look, let's continue on. Look at the second trumpet, Revelation chapters 8, verses 8 and 9. The second angel sounded, and as it were, a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and a third part of the sea became blood, and a third part of the creatures of the sea that had life died, and a third part of the ships were destroyed. So now what do we have? Well, previous one, you had a third part of the trees, third part of the green grass. Now here you got the third part of the seas, the ships, right? You've got all these things, right? So again, how is the judgment falling? In what? Always in reference to thirds. All right, well, look at this. Go down to the Revelation 8, verses 10 and 11. It says, "And a third angel sounded, And there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp, and it fell upon the third part of the rivers, and upon the fountains of waters. The name of the star was called Wormwood, and the third part of the waters became wormwood. Many men died of the waters because they became bitter." So again, how are the judgments falling? In thirds, right? Well, let's continue on. Let's keep reading. Now look at the fourth trumpet. "And the fourth angel sounded, and a third part of the sun was smitten, a third part of the moon, and a third part of the stars, so as the third part of them was darkened. And the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise." And again, how are the judgments falling? In thirds. Right? Go over with me to the sixth trumpet, Revelation chapter 9, verse 15, and then verse 18. Look what it says in verse 15. It says this, "And the four angels were loosed, and which were prepared for an hour, a day, and a month, and a year, for to slay a third part of the men." And verse 18 says the same thing. It says, "By these three was the third part of the men killed, by fire and by smoke and brimstone which issue out of their mouths." So again, judgment's falling where? On thirds. Now look, the question is, why is it mentioning all these thirds? A third, always, at least it seems, from first four trumpets and then the sixth trumpet. All right, now look. When we look at the only powers that can fulfill this, and at least in terms of the options you only have Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, or pagan Rome. Clearly, we know from the scripture, Revelation chapter 8 and 7, it falls upon the earth, at least the then known world, or the world at large. Look, let's put it this way. You have to interpret that verse one of two ways. Either it means the world at large, as we presently understand it, which then means you'd have to interpret how? Present day. In other words, you'd have to interpret it in the future. Or you're going to have to take this historically understood, meaning the then known world. Then it leaves you option with only four powers to choose from, because we understand what the powers are both from Daniel and Revelation. So it means Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, or pagan Rome. Well, when you look at the characteristics of the judgments falling in thirds, I think it clearly indicates the nature of the kingdom itself. In other words, look, we know that Scripture teaches that Rome would be divided into two parts. We know that from the legs of iron. That's from the earliest part of the division of the Rome. We also know that when studying the Roman Empire from the western part and the eastern part in terms of the division, we know, historically speaking, when you come to the gentleman by the name of Constantine, we know, matter of fact, it even happened before him, that the kingdom was divided, or at least pagan, or the Roman Empire, was divided into three parts amongst his three sons. You see, when he was dying, he wanted to leave each one of his sons a part of the kingdom so that they could all rule and be kings. So he divided the kingdom up into thirds. And each son ruled and reigned in his own part of the kingdom, which was then formerly the Roman Empire. Let me read to you a statement by Albert Barnes. He's a Presbyterian. And even though he's a Presbyterian, or was, he's since passed away, but nonetheless, I think he was in many ways an incredible Protestant preacher. I mean, his commentaries are loaded with truths. Not everything, of course, but nonetheless, for a man of his time, I think the Lord tremendously blessed him. Nonetheless, let me read to you this. This is taken from Albert Barnes' notes on the book of Revelation, chapter 12, verse 4. He says this about the Roman Empire. He said, twice at least before the Roman Empire became divided permanently into two parts, the Eastern and the Western, there was a tripartite division of the empire. The first occurred in A.D. 311, when it was divided between Constantine, Licinius, and Maximin. The other was in A.D. 337, on the death of Constantine, and it was divided between his three sons. And then, of course, Constantine II, Constans, and Constantus. And so, you have the kingdom being divided into three, and it was done twice. This is in reference to the Roman Empire. Now, this is a historical fact that Rome was divided into exactly three sections. Now, listen, you don't have Babylon, Medo-Persia, or Greece that, as far as I know of, was ever divided into three kingdoms. See, it's interesting to note, for example, in the book of Daniel chapter 8, and even in chapter 7, when speaking of Greece, when Alexander the Great died, his kingdom was divided into how many parts? Into four. Now, we know that. We know what happened when Nebuchadnezzar died. His kingdom was not divided at all. It just continued to stay the same until eventually, of course, Medo-Persia took it. Now, the Medes and the Persians were two kingdoms into one, merging into one. Eventually, of course, the Persians would overrule the Medes because they were actually more powerful than the Medes, and they simply disintegrated under the power of Alexander the Great, never to be divided in terms of prior to that into kingdoms themselves. So I think the evidence, once again, it's that logical, based on evidence, conclude, you know, just simply logically looking at things. It's a process of elimination, looking at the evidence and saying, look, it can only lead me in one direction. Remember, one thing to understand the minutiae, it's another thing to keep your eyes on the direction of where you're going. I think the evidence clearly admits that this can only refer to pagan Rome, that it can only indicate that these judgments are falling upon this empire. Now, keep that in the light of the fact that you have, prior to that, the prelude of the mediation ceasing. All right, now look, like Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, each of them were given an opportunity to receive the gospel message. You know, prior to Babylon ruling and the people of God going into captivity, remember this, that the children of Israel refused to go and take the gospel to the world. You remember God kept pleading with them, go to the world, go to the world. They refused. They began to get a mindset of how somehow the Gentiles really were unclean and we shouldn't associate with them and, you know, we'll get polluted and this kind of thing. And so eventually God basically, in the essence, was simply saying this. Well, since you will not go to them, I will bring them to you. And I will, instead of you willingly and graciously going to preach the gospel, I will force you to preach the gospel. I will arrange circumstances in such a way I will make you tell the truth. One way or the other, you're going to tell the truth. And that's precisely what happened. Babylon came and took them, subjugated them, spread them all over the world, our then known world. And the same with Medo-Persia, same with Greece. Same with Rome. Each case, God was trying to help the Jews to realize their responsibility. And each time, the Jews failed. Finally culminating in the ultimate rejection of the Son of God. But you see, every single time, even though these powers were used by God to accomplish the will of God in the preaching of the gospel through the Jews, they at the same time were being now held accountable for the light of the Jews in the presence of their midst. You see, even though he thought they were going to rule the Jews, God had a purpose in mind. What does the Bible say in Ezekiel? You know, in the essence is God does what? He sets up kings and he puts them down until the ultimately king comes, and that's Jesus Christ. Now look, isn't it true with pagan Rome? Didn't it happen with them? Didn't God send them the light of the gospel? Sure, not only in regard to the Jews, but also Jesus Christ. And not only with Jesus, but then the apostles. How much light did they have? They had an enormous amount of light. And what did they do with that light? Well, I think we know a little bit of the history, at least some of it. We know what happened in pagan Rome. The pagans began to persecute the Christians. We understand that from the seven churches. Even the seven seals teach us that. But eventually what happened? Well, a transition took place, didn't it? Because every time they began to persecute the Christians began to multiply. And they multiplied to the extent that the emperors of Rome began to realize they're in trouble because now the Christians outnumber the pagans. In order to retain power, what did they do? Well, what did Constantine do? What did all these other emperors do? What did they do? They professed what? Christianity. But were they Christians? Of course not. They weren't Christian. They were no more Christian than a pig is clean to eat. Now look, they only did that for what? Political reasons. To retain political power. Now look, a transition was taking place. Pagan Rome was becoming, quote, and I put these in quote, Christianized. But look, you cannot retain pagan traditions, veneer it with Christian, quote, words or values, and somehow still think you're going to have truth. So what did they do? Constantine wasn't foolish, and neither were some of the other emperors. They realized that the impact, they had to become Christians, or at least appeal to the Christian base. But at the same time, they were pagans, through and through. And they were going to retain their pagan philosophy. Now, this is interesting. I want you to watch this. From the very inception, what was the plague that always attacked the Jews, historically speaking? What was the one thing that they kept yielding to? And wasn't it paganism? Idolatry? Sure it was. Whether it was paganism of Babylon, Medo-Persia, or whether it was Greece, Assyria, Egypt. It doesn't matter. All of these powers were pagan in nature. They didn't worship the true God. But it always plagued the Jews. The Philistines, the Jebusites, the Moabites, they were all pagans. And paganism was a means with which the devil used to infiltrate Christianity and destroy them. Right? Now watch what the devil does. Now watch this now. During the pagan Roman Empire, paganism is reigning supreme. In the days of Jesus, paganism is supreme. But by the time you get down to the apostles, then you get to the 3rd and 4th century, what's happening? You've got a transition occurring from pagan Rome to papal Rome. What is the devil doing? Did he get rid of paganism? No, because that's the tool he's always used. All he did was change, as we say, you change the horse. You keep the same rider, but you just change the horse. Now look, what did he do? He changed the veneer, the garb. He didn't change the nature of the beast. Paganism is still paganism, no matter how much. Look, we're living in the holiday seasons right now, right? And there's a holiday, Christmas is coming, right around the corner. Now look, though, we know the origin of that day. We understand the significance of that. We know it has to do with paganism. But what did Justinian and all these other emperors constantly, what did they all do? They Christianized paganism. That's what they did. They appealed to their pagan base and at the same time appeased the Christians. And the Christians, who were lukewarm, compromised their integrity and yielded to the position for political reasons as well. They too wanted power. And remember what Paul said to the Ephesians. Remember what he said to the Ephesians there in Acts chapter 20. Remember what he said. From among you, and he's speaking to the elders now, he said, from among you will arise men, speaking perversely, to draw away disciples after them. He said, where would the apostasy start from? From within. Well, how is it going to come from within unless you change the nature of what's within? Now look, a transition is taking place. And then the deception went from paganism to papalism. It's still paganism. It's just a different way of appealing to it. You see, before that transition was complete from paganism to papalism, judgments would come. In other words, an opportunity was given to pagan Rome, just like Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. They were given an opportunity to receive the gospel. They, as a nation and as a world empire, refused to do so. And so now being held accountable for the light, like each of us are individually, so we are collectively as a nation, and so we are collectively as a world. They are now held in judgment. God will no longer mediate in their behalf as a world empire. In other words, it's going to come to an end. And now the censer will be cast down and judgments will be cast to the earth. Trumpet after trumpet will begin to blow. We now know, there's no doubt in my mind, that these trumpets can only refer to the pagan Roman Empire. It can't refer to any other power. It's impossible. It's impossible. Now, let's look quickly at the first four, and let's look at the breakdown of the first four, because we're going to get to the five and six, because we have a little time prophecy in five and six, don't we? Yes, actually, we have two time prophecies we need to cover, and we need to deal with that, because it is important. And we're going to look at it. Now, again, what I'm going to do for the sake of time, once again, I'm just going to pass through some of them, just covering a few points, and then we're just going to go on. I just want to give the historic fulfillment, some dates, and then we'll just keep marching through. One thing I want to say, though, before I begin, on the dates. Just like, for example, the seals, and even at least some of the seals, and some of the churches, in terms of the church age, there has to be a, a time frame, or at least in some cases there's a time frame to work with. Not necessarily specific dates. For example, when we get the time prophecies, we need specific dates, don't we? Isn't that right? Yeah, I mean, it's natural. If you're going to deal with the time prophecy, you need a specific starting point to indicate the specific end of that time period, whatever that may be. But in this case, we don't have time periods here, do we? No, not until you get to the fifth and the sixth trumpet. Then you have specific time periods. Now, that's only indicating certain events within that time frame. In other words, you can have a time frame, and I'll just give an example, you can have a time frame that lasts, say, 400 years. But there may be within that time frame a 50-year prophecy. That will be specific, but not the 400 years. That's just a kind of a guesstimation. You're giving a kind of an idea within that framework. But these 50 years definitely have to fall within that framework. In other words, you couldn't put this year or this end of this time frame before the 50 years, and you couldn't put this one after. It has to fall within. All right, but look, you'll find that in the fifth and the sixth. Even though the general tendency may be somewhat generic in its approach, but the specifics will come when it gets to the prophecy. Now, there's another time when prophecy becomes specific. That's if it's mentioning some particular event at a particular time. In other words, when all the evidence is leading to one event, one place and time. Then you can only say, for example, and I'll show you this, when we get to the fifth trumpet. When you look at the star that fell to the earth in the fifth trumpet. Now, this is clearly indicating Muhammad. All right, but we know when he rose to power. In other words, we actually have historians who give a specific date when he came and really basically took the reins in his hand. That's 622. So that's a specific event. But generally speaking, the trumpets individually will take on a generic. Now, there's some accuracy will be at least in certain dates, but not everything will be specific within that. You'll see, for example, what I mean is if you look at commentaries, dealing with the churches, dealing with the seals, even dealing with the trumpets, not all of them, but some of them, you're going to see the dates vary. Oh, they have a proximity, but the dates vary. I'm not worried about that. The proximity doesn't bother me. Long as you're, as we say, as long as you are within the ballpark, you know, within the framework, that's fine with me. Where I would have a problem is if you took something that was supposed to be specific, in other words, very precise, and then made it very general. Then I would have the problem there. Or if you took that which was supposed to be specific and placed other dates upon it that are not relevant to the fulfillment of that prophecy. Again, I would have a problem with that. Or if you took the dates and you simply took the prophecy and launched it into the future or maybe into the past and gave a whole other spin to it, I would have a problem with that. But when it comes to the trumpets in specifics, or at least, excuse me, each trumpet generally, as long as you're within that framework, that's fine. That's okay by me. Now, that's me. Some others may not feel that way. But I think that when you're not given any specifics, you can't anchor yourself in concrete. You understand? This difference, 1260, 2300 days, the beginning and the end, that's anchored in concrete. You cannot move those dates. You cannot move, for example, to 1260, 538 to 1790. I'm sorry. It's not 539. It's not 537. It's 538. It's not 1799, 1797. No, it's 1798. Those dates cannot be moved. You understand what I'm saying now? I just want to kind of lay a few things because some people might want to question those things. But let's look at the first four trumpets and let's give some of the specifics here as best we can, and then we'll talk about some of the aspects in a broader way. Well, let's look at the first one first of all. Here we have in Revelation chapter 8. There in verse 7 it says, the first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth. And a third part of the trees were burnt up, and all the grass was burnt up. All right, so we know there's judgments on a then-known world empire. We clearly, I think, look at the evidence, and there's only one power that can fulfill that. That's pagan Rome, based on the evidence given within that. So here we have the first judgment upon the pagan Roman Empire. Now, think historically speaking. Where are we in the point of time? Well, we know we're in Rome, but where in Rome? I mean, are we in the days of Christ? Are we after the days of Jesus? I mean, and where, you know, now we can get a guesstimation again. I'm not looking for the specifics, but we can understand this. Let's put it this way. We now know, even though the kingdom was divided into, as they call it, a unit kingdom, divided into three units, we know also, based on the prophecy of Daniel 7, Daniel 2, We also know from Revelation 12, Revelation 13, we know that the pagan Roman Empire will eventually be divided up into 10 kingdoms. Isn't that right? Sure, we know that. But is it the entire kingdom that will be divided up, or only one segment of the kingdom will be divided up into 10 kingdoms? It's only one segment, isn't it? Remember, the kingdom of Rome eventually gets divided into two parts, Eastern and Western. Which falls first? Historically, now this is just a history lesson. Which one fell? I don't even need to look at the Bible, and I know historically speaking, which one fell first? Yeah, of course it did. We know that. That's a fact of life. I mean, I don't know, unless somebody wants to rewrite history, which I know that's the popular thing to do today, because history is something that's very offensive to a lot of people. Well, look. We know this has to refer to pagan Roman Empire. We know it has to refer, at least the first trumpet, has to refer to the Western part. We know that. History bears that out. The prophecy bears that out. So we know it has to refer to Western Rome. The question again is when? When? Well, when we look at this, first of all, let's get this down. I mean, I want to write this down. The first judgment is going to take place from a man by the name of Alaric. He is a Goth of origin. He does come, you'll notice that it says hail. Now, unlike the blood mingled with fire, it's interesting to note, it gives us an indication of the location of this power, where Alaric would come from. First of all, it says he would have a hail. Now, hail can only come from a cold region. It has to come from a cold region. Now, somebody said, well, what about the fire? Fire's hot. Well, yeah, but you can have fire in the wintertime. You can have fire in the middle of the North Pole. Fire is not relegated to location, but hail is. Hail is relegated to a particular region. It can only happen in the cold. Now, so in other words, clearly the word hail is not necessarily dealing with judgment in the terms of actual hail falling. It's dealing with location, identifying mark, in other words. It's trying to indicate who is coming to send judgment on the Roman Empire. Well, it's a power that comes out of the north. And the only power that you can find at that time, and by the way, the time frame, and this again, this is pure, well, it's not all guesstimation, but I mean, some of the dates are specific. Things did occur, but it's a framework that you can work with. 395 all the way to 412 A.D., and you have judgments being sent by Alaric. Now, let me just read to you when Alaric invaded. And by the way, all of these powers that came, it seems to me when you look at them, it's almost as if everyone that followed got worse and worse. And it just seemed to culminate into this ultimate judgment. And all of these powers were bloodthirsty individuals or tribes. And eventually, of course, and what you're actually looking at in the first four trumpets, because it's referring to Western Rome, the ultimate breakup would culminate in what? Well, how about the Ten Kingdoms? Isn't that right? Isn't that true? Sure it was. Which would then eventually give way to what? How about the little horn? Isn't that right? So what are you getting here, really? You're getting a detailed description of the fall of not only Western Rome, but the development and the rise of the little horn. So Alaric begins the first. He commences with this. And then it continues on. And let's move on to this. Let me go quickly here. Yes, Edward Gibbons of the Roman Empire. This is the classic book, if you should ever find it. He said this, chapter 33, speaking of Alaric. He said, the union of the Roman Empire was dissolved. Its genius was humbled in the dust, and armies of unknown barbarians issuing from the frozen regions of the north had established their victorious reign over the fairest provinces of Europe and Africa. Now, over the frozen regions of the north. Now, here's a historian indicating the actual process of what happened, and sure enough, long before Edward Gibbons ever wrote his masterpiece, God indicated hail coming out of the north, blood mingled with fire. And this, of course, that is not referring to location. That's actually referring to the basic extent of the judgment in terms of what Alaric would do. So there would be judgments. He would be the first. He would bring it upon him. Then comes the second. And in the second trumpet, we have this. This is, of course, Revelation 8. And starting with verse 8, it says, the second angel sounded, and as it were a great mountain burning with fire, was cast into the sea. Now, let me read it and then we'll finish it. And then the third part of the sea became blood, and the third part of the creatures of the sea, which were in the sea, had life, died, and the third part of the ships were destroyed. Well, here we find a mountain. Now, a mountain in Bible prophecy, believe it or not, you know a mountain represents a kingdom? Yes. Think of Daniel chapter 2 for a moment. The stone cut out without hands, smote the image upon his feet, and then what rose up? Of course, we know the image was crumbled and disintegrated. What rose up in its place? A great what? Mountain. Isn't that right? What did that mountain represent? The kingdom of the Lord Jesus. Isn't that right? Sure it did. Mountains of proper prophecy represent kingdoms. So here comes a great kingdom. Here comes a kingdom, and it's burning with fire. And it's cast where? Into the sea. And it's interesting, in every one of these, it's talking about ships. It's talking about the sea. It's talking those who lived it, the creatures in the sea. They died. So the conquest here would have to be not land. Now, this would be by, actually, as it indicated, sea, the waters. In other words, what do we have here? And really what we have here, and I'm going to put the dates down. The dates, of course, here would be 429 to 468. Of course, this is all A.D. And this would be Genseric. And he, of course, was a Vandal. Now, anybody understand anything about the Vandals? Well, Vandals were a tribe of people who came from Northern Africa. And Northern Africa, of course, borders, obviously, Southern Europe, or which is now, of course, Southern Europe, and it is the Mediterranean Sea. Now, listen, we know that Genseric, a Vandal, was so vicious and brutal that he annihilated the Roman Empire, in terms of the ships, and he just simply gutted them out. And what's interesting, though, he was so brutal, and I'm sure you probably know this, but for those who don't, he was so vicious that the word Vandal became vandalism, because that's how brutal he was. But nonetheless, Genseric was a brilliant naval commander. There's no doubt about what his feats were. But he came again, and now you have, instead of the northern tribes coming in, now you have the southern tribes sweeping in. So they're coming from every direction. And he commences in with that in the third part, or again, the seas, the ships, all of that is commencing the destruction of the naval power of the Roman Empire. Well, now we come to the third trumpet real quickly. And it goes on to say this in 10 and 11. And a third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp, and it fell upon the third part of the rivers and the fountains of waters. And the name of the star was called Wormwood. And the third part of the waters became Wormwood. Many men died in the waters because they were made bitter. All right. So here once again we have a star falling from heaven. Now, what does a star represent in prophecy? Well, remember this, and I'll show you this in a second when we get into the fourth trumpet. In the book of Genesis, you remember how that God said he put the sun to rule the day and the moon to rule the night, along with the stars, they would rule the night. So the sun and the moon and the stars, in this particular case we're looking at the stars, signify something specifically. In the light of Genesis, and as other places as well, we know that also that Jesus holds the seven stars in his right hand, signifying not only the seven churches, but the leaders within those churches. So it's leadership. Authority, someone in authority, somebody in leadership. So here comes a power, somebody who's in a great leader, and it says here that he's a star that fell from heaven and he's burning as a lamp. In other words, the indication he would not last long at all. In other words, like a meteor just coming through. He'd burn and he would burn bright, he'd burn strong, but it would not last for very long. And of course, this is a great depiction, in terms of describing Tel Avihan. And that's precisely what you have in this power here. Let me just kind of put down some dates here. In 441, Attila the Hun actually had a union, or made a union with the Vandals. But his conquest, in terms of the actual engaging in conflict of war, you realize it only lasted from 451 to 453. That's not long. 3 years? That's not long at all. Well, two, if you want to take it that way, that's right. You could take it either way. But nonetheless, but if we want to get technical again, if you want to start it with this date, that's fine with me. I'm not going to sit there and, hold anything against anybody. That's for sure. But, he was so vicious that even himself, I can't imagine, but somebody so brutal to have the audacity to sit there and say, I'm the scourge of God upon those, that I came to punish. I don't know, maybe he saw himself that way, obviously he did, but it's a pretty bold statement to be making. He was a very feared man, there's no doubt about it. Anybody who does any kind of history of Attila the Hun knows that this man was pretty vicious. As a matter of fact, he was so boastful. It said that he would that the grass would never grow where his horse would trod. That's how wicked, or at least he envisioned himself. Do you know, in the year 451, just to show you the bloodthirsty of these guys, he fought a battle in Chalons, in Gaul, in 451. He left on the field 300,000 men dead in one battle. 300,000. Now, I don't know about you, but that is brutal. Absolutely brutal. You know, I live in not far from a battlefield, and it's one of the most famous battlefields in America. It's a Civil War battlefield, and it's the Battle of Antietam or Sharpsburg. On that day, and only one day, 23 or 24,000 men died or were wounded on that day, in one day. And at one time at the battle, a man was either wounded or killed every second for several hours. Every second somebody was falling. I mean, that is unthinkable. But that pales into insignificance when you think that Attila the Hun, this is not 300,000. I don't know of a battle anywhere, I mean, in terms of that number, but maybe. There may be others. I probably is, but that is unthinkable. That's how bloodthirsty some of these people were. And Attila the Hun apparently just didn't think much of it, I suspect. But nonetheless, judgments were falling now upon Rome. You know, it's interesting, as I said, it kind of gets worse as it goes on. But remember this, the judgments are in comparison to the rejection of the light that Rome received. Remember that. Judgment, whether it falls on us individually, or a family, or a city, or a town, or a nation, or a world, it's always in proportion to the light you receive. That's why I believe, when we look at the destruction of the wicked, I believe former Seventh-day Adventists and Jews will be the last ones to burn, particularly Jews who lived in Jesus' day. Do you know why? You got that right, brother. That's what it boils down to. That's what it simply, they had the greater light. I mean, we have greater light than the Jews who lived in Jesus' day. Now, it's hard to believe because they could actually touch, feel, and walk, you know, sit and actually eat a meal with the Lord Jesus Christ. But we have actually greater light than they. And I really believe that they will be among the last to go. Now, Satan will be the very low end. We know that because he'll be the very last one. He started it all. But it's still unbelievable when you think of how terrible things, they keep progressing. One's getting worse than the next and the next. Well, let's go on to the fourth one. As we continue on, because I'm going to move along here, because we've got to get to the fifth and the sixth. Now, in verse 12, it says, the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars. So as the third part of them were darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. All right, well, now, look, the sun and the moon and the stars, that's the significant part of the judgments. Well, I go back to Genesis chapter 1. And let's go look there quickly, because I made reference to it, but let's quickly look there real quick in Genesis chapter 1. I want to read the verses and to give you the reference. Genesis chapter 1, starting there with verse 14, it says, God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night. Let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. Let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made two great lights. The greater light, and here's the thing, to rule the day, the lesser light, to rule the night, he made the stars also. And again, and we can keep reading, but I think it's sufficient right there. But look, clearly it indicates that the sun and the moon and the stars were given, in this case, metaphorically speaking, of authority, to rule. Well, this is referring to pagan Rome, though. But it says a third part of the stars, a third part of the moon, and a third part of the sun. So what is that indicating? In other words, what is that telling us? Well, now look, we now know as it progresses on in the fall of the Roman Empire, and again, I'm going to, at this point, designate the actual date here. This is 476 A.D., and it goes all the way up to the 6th. Now, again, this date can change in reference to the 4th. I'm using this one, 622, because of Muhammad in leading into the 5th. But nonetheless, 476 is a date that cannot be altered. As far as I'm, in reference to the division of the Western Roman Empire, finally culminating of the 10 kingdoms, that date is fixed. Any decent historian, I know no one who would even venture to challenge that date. But nonetheless, let's get it down here. Odasser, who of course is a Heruli, And what about the sun, the moon, and the stars? Well, let's look symbolically, at least in terms of the Genesis account. Which is the greater, the sun or the moon or the stars? The sun. No doubt. Which comes next? The moon. And then the stars. This is natural. All right, now look. We know it represents leadership. So thinking in regard to the Roman Empire, leadership. So which was the greatest leader? Now, in the Roman Empire, you had three forms of government, or at least in terms of a system of government. You had Caesar, the Senate, and then you had consulship. So you have each of them indicating a particular part of the authority or political system. Let's just put it that way. In the sun and the moon and the stars. And the Gosser, of course, of the Herulean coming. And finally, this puts the end to the Roman Empire, at least the western part, and thus giving way to the ten kingdoms. And finally, the little horn. Now, what's interesting at this point is you're getting a lot of the history, or at least the terms of the impact, of what this means to God's people. Because it's given way to pagan Rome, into papal Rome. Nonetheless, God's people had to endure pagan Rome. Now they're going to have to endure what? Papal Rome. Now, according to Revelation 8, 3 through 5, does mediation still plead for God's people? Yeah, you see, because that's why I wanted to bring out that point earlier. Look, God doesn't forsake His people. Judgments are falling, but do they fall upon God's people? No, of course not. Will they receive some of the effects? In other words, look, let's be honest. I mean, if they destroy all the cattle or the orchards, well, you may not be able to eat certain items anymore, at least temporarily. So you may be deprived of certain necessities of life, but you're not going to suffer in the sense that you'll die or you'll perish. You may be without. Remember what it says in the last days of the plagues? What will happen to God's people? Will they be able to go to the grocery stores? No. But what does it say in Isaiah? Your bread and water shall be sure. We may have to do without, but we will not die. So we may have received at least some of the effects, but we will not be directly punished or judged in regard to that. All right, so this now culminates that point. Now we come to the fifth or trumpet. Let's look at that real quick here. All right, I'm not going to go through the ten horns or ten, I'm just going to move on. Because I really want to get to the time prophecies. There's some very interesting reasons why I want to do this. Look with me here in Revelation 9. Now in Revelation 9, and really it's Revelation 9, 1 through 11. Now I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I just want to give the references. Then I'm going to talk about specific parts in the prophecy itself. But Revelation 9, 1 through 11. Now we have a star, it says in verse 1, the fifth angel sounded. By the way, go back with me to verse 13 of chapter 8. I want to show you something. This is interesting. While I was studying this, I began to realize something very important. Look what it says in verse 13 of chapter 8. I beheld and heard an angel fly through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice. You know, at this point in time, doesn't that sound like the three angels? It's almost verbatim. I mean, absolutely verbatim. Now look what he goes on to say. Saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound. You see, there's another three angels message. It's the three angels of Revelation 9 and 10 and part of 11. And you know, it's interesting, these three angels culminate in the three angels message of Revelation 14. Because when you get to the seventh, that's where it's all heading. So there's another set of three angels. Actually, when I read that, I thought, well, now I'm going to work on a sermon called The Three Angels of Revelation 9 and 10. I know it's going to cause you to think, what is he talking about? But it's true. It says it. Because I really, really want to go is at that point of the seventh angel. Well, let's go on quickly. Well, a star fell from heaven, as it said here, to the earth. And to him was given the key to the bottomless pit. And the bottomless pit was open, and there arose smoke out of the pit, and smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke out of the pit. Well, you know, you stop there again. Logic looking at it. The sun and air darkened by the smoke. Well, you know, we could live with, at least to a certain extent, for only a period of time, with the sun maybe being overshadowed by smog and fog and all that kind of stuff. But you couldn't live forever. Obviously, nature itself would wither away. Even we would. It's actually, you know, beneficial in many ways for us. Obviously, life specifically. But you can't live very long without air. So what do we have here? A concept of what? The suffocation of life. You know, to capture the overall. Try not to get the, again, we always want detail. try to capture the general concept. What's he conveying? Look, here we've got a star falling out of heaven. All of a sudden he's got a key to the bottomless pit. A bottomless pit, by the way, in prophecy, you can look at that, means a place of captivity, a desolate place. We know that. Revelation 20 and other places clearly indicate this. So it's the origin of this star leadership. He's coming, and he's given authority. That's what the key represents, authority, to unlock an ideology, a philosophy, a religion, if you please, that would suffocate life. Now, light, the sun, light, air, they're synonymous, really, in terms of the concept of the gospel. The gospel is light. The gospel is the light of life. It's the fresh air of life. It's the breath of life, as it's called. The breath of life. The gospel is the breath of life. Look, what do we have? You put all this together, it can only lead you to one point. That we're going to have a counterfeit religion rise up that would suffocate the truth. Now, what's interesting here, we already know this, that the first four refer to the western part of the Roman Empire, but we know Rome was divided into two parts, isn't that right? So, clearly Rome, western, is already fallen, divided up. Now, because I want to show you something about the little horn. Now look, here we have the fifth and the sixth. Alright, so there's number five and there's six. So, who do we have coming here in 622 that would bring a religion that would basically not only attack the eastern part of the Roman Empire, but also would eventually threaten the gospel itself? Yeah, there can only be, historically speaking, now this is interesting, I'm going to write a few things down for the sake of getting it done here. This is Muhammad and Islam, and the rise of Islam. Muhammad is talked about, no doubt about it. It goes on in the prophecy talking about the scorpions and the locusts and all. Again, these are the followers, those who would enforce, those who would, you know, it's like a plague, they'd spread out. What's interesting, though, which many people don't realize, is in some ways we're indebted to Islam. Listen very carefully what I mean by this. Listen very, very carefully. Now, this is the eastern part of the Roman Empire, isn't it? Isn't that right? Yeah, well, there's no doubt about it. Now, what's interesting? Now, think of this. The Western Rome has fallen, right? It's fallen. And as you go down, and the little horn, now think of this, when does the little horn rise to power? In other words, he takes preeminence. When? What's the date? 538. Muhammad rises when? 622. So he rises afterwards. So Rome has not quite a century. I'm speaking of pagan Rome. Has not quite a century to basically be unmolested. I mean in terms of no competition. Right? Now think of this though. What has she done during this time? From 538 to 622. What has she done? Well, if you continue the reading, she progresses, by the way, in doing this, because it's not just 622, but it's thereafter. What does she do? Well, she persecutes the people of God. She not only persecutes the people of God, what does she do? She takes away the Holy Bible. She took away the manuscripts, and she began to put it in the Latin Vulgate, and other things, traditions, and so forth. All these things come in, now, which is the purest Greek. Where did it come from? The western part or the eastern part? Came from the east. Now listen, Muhammad may have started here, but eventually he headed west, didn't he? Isn't that true? In other words, he started in the east. Didn't he? He swooped down, came in from the east, right? Took back, at least that section of it, right? But he wasn't content there because around the, not him, but his followers, Islam itself, would eventually in the 8th century head where? Yes, into Europe. Into Europe. But now what's interesting? What's interesting is this. When he drove towards the west, the people of God, the people like they're called the Picards, the Paulians. And by the way, some believe these people to be the forerunners of the Waldensians. In other words, they were forced out of the east into the west. But when they came with them, when they fled, they brought with them the eastern manuscripts. Sister White says the Waldensians had the true Bible. Did y'all know that? That the Waldensians had the true Bible, meaning the manuscript itself. Where did they get the manuscript from? Well, they get it from the West. I can guarantee you that, probably. You do any history of that, you know full well they didn't come from the West. Had to come from the East. Well, how in the world would they get it from the East? Unless, providentially, God using Muhammad in the sense that as a judgment, but through the circumstances, you know, listen, the hand of God in history is everywhere. And he forced them out of the East because the West was becoming what? In total darkness. Right? Well, by what? By papalism. Right? So they fled into the West. Where? Into the Western Mountains, the Alps, the Swiss, the Italian Alps. They fled into that region. They brought with them. And by the way, did you know not only did they bring the manuscripts with them, but this began the opening, and which would later progress into what they call the Renaissance Age. In other words, they brought with them not only the manuscripts, but as century after century began to develop to the Islam and they kept pushing westward, people would flee naturally, which is only, I mean, you wouldn't want to stick around with these guys. I mean, they were brutal. And as I said, they're worse than all the guys who went before. So the arts, the sciences that were in the East that were not molested by the papacy in the West, the papacy couldn't molest the East. So all of these sciences that would actually open the door to what? Yes, the Reformation. It could only happen unless someone pushed all that knowledge westward. And the only way you could do it was by invading it. And that's precisely what you have in Mohammed, opening the door to the future Reformation. And so even though Islam is depicted in the Bible as smoke coming from the bottomless pit, in other words, a deception, suffocation of life itself, meaning the gospel, nonetheless, like Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, pagan Rome, like Cyrus, like Nebuchadnezzar, other powers or individuals we could name that God actually used, Haziel, God used Haziel, right? Sure he did. He wasn't a Christian, that's not the point. God used him to accomplish his will. You know, Paul says nothing can be done against the gospel. You know that everything that's done against us is actually done for us in terms of the gospel itself? Nothing can be done. Look, this Muhammad and Islam, even though it was a counterfeit, even though it was a deception in terms of its work, God would use that to achieve something in the end. In other words, he would use it to his advantage in opening the door to the Reformation in regard to the little horn. All of this was coming out from the East into the West. Well, let's move here because I'm really slipping away. I'm not going to worry about the hurt the grass. There's an interesting statement, though, if you want it. I'll give it to you here. Let me see if I can find it. It's from Daniel Revelation by Uriah Smith, a very good statement, page 567 and 568. This is a direct quote, by the way, of Abu Bakr. And in 632 A.D., he was the successor of Muhammad, and he made an unbelievable statement. It's incredible when you think of this. Now, one thing I do want to bring out, and people have often asked me about this, well, what do you do about verse 4, those who have the seal of God in their foreheads? Well, let me say something to you on regard to this. First of all, one thing we need to get cleared up. First of all, it says the seal of God. First of all, let's work on the basic concept of what we know to be truth. Then we can try to work our way through various other areas. Ezekiel chapter 20, 12 and 20. Cross-reference it over to Romans chapter 4, verse 11. You know, the sign and the seal, that word is interchangeable. We know biblically speaking that the Sabbath is the sign of God or the seal of God. Now listen. Is the Sabbath the seal of God only in the last days, or has it always been the seal of God? Yes, it's always been the seal of God. Remember what Jesus said in Mark 2:27. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. In other words, God instituted the Sabbath as a memorial. One, creation. Second, redemption. And the third is what? And sanctification, meaning, and of course, Hebrews chapter 4, the Sabbath being a sign of God's rest, sanctification, or the Sabbath itself, the grace of God. All right, look. So what we have here is clearly an indication that is referring to the Sabbath. Now, one thing I wanted to say, is there a distinction? I'm going to ask you this question. Is there a distinction between the seal of God and the sealing? And that's kind of a trick question. I know that. Maybe I should rephrase it, but let me put it in. Is there a relationship between the two? Yes. Is there a difference between the two? Yes. Just like justification, sanctification, do they have a relationship? Absolutely. Are they separate in the sense of distinct aspects of them? Absolutely. All right, look. The seal of God is the Sabbath. What is the sealing, though? It has to do with the Sabbath because it culminates in the seal itself. Isn't that right? Sure. But what is the sealing? Sister White says the sealing constitutes two things. Settling into the truth. How? Intellectually and spiritually or experientially. In other words, you're actually living it. It's not enough to have a mental assent to truth, is it? Will that get you to heaven? Of course not. The devil knows not only what you know, he knows more than you. But it's not going to save his soul. It's too late for him. All right, look, the sealing is a process whereby God seals you with the Sabbath. And that process is a settling into the truth by first understanding it. So you can't experience what you don't know, right? I mean, that's common sense. How can you experience something you don't know? You have to experience, or you have to know something to experience it. So That's why in Isaiah chapter 1, come now, let us reason together. God is always appealing to the mind. So it's important that we understand this, that God's people, and I believe there were Sabbath keepers even in that day, there's no doubt about it, but clearly we have a group of people that were followers of God who were not going to be molested. Now I go back again to that reference to Revelation 8, 3 through 5, the mediation of God. Does God protect His children? Yes. Were the judgments to fall upon God's people? No. These judgments had nothing to do with God's people, did they? Did they? No, of course not. They were upon pagan Rome, not upon God's people. So the plagues, or in this case, the trumpets, in terms of when they were falling, had nothing to do with the punishing of God's people. So why would they be punished? In other words, what is God indicating? In the midst of this conflict and this terrible ordeal, will God protect His people? Yes. Just like the seven last plagues, it's terrible ordeal. Will not God protect His people who have what? The seal of God in their foreheads. Sabbath keepers have always had, those who are loyal to God, have always had the Sabbath or the seal of God. In other words, they're keeping the Sabbath holy. And in this case, there's no doubt that they're Sabbath keepers. And, or those who follow the Lord in sincerity of their heart. Think about, for example, in Romans. There are those who are going to be in heaven. We know this from Zechariah. We also know there's going to be those in heaven who never heard of Jesus. Isn't that right? But how does God judge them? According to the law, where? Romans says, that's right, the law that's written in their heart. But how does God judge them? Disobedient or obedient? He judges them obedient. As though they were Sabbath keepers, as though they kept the Ten Commandments, in the sense of them having knowledge of Christ and salvation. But they're judged according to the light. Are there those in this day who may not have heard of the Sabbath, but who were truly loving the Lord, follow the Lord Jesus, who were considered God's children? Absolutely. Absolutely. No doubt about it. But now listen to me very carefully. At the end of time, only those who have the seal of God will endure through the seven last plagues. Isn't that right? Yes. But not only those who have the seal of God are not the only ones saved. Isn't that right? Sure. There are others who are going to be in heaven who never even heard of the Sabbath. But they'll keep the Sabbath. Remember, when we get to heaven, how long is it going to take us to get to heaven? 7 days. Somewhere along the way, we're going to keep the Sabbath, whether it be just before we enter the gates or not. One of those days is going to be the Sabbath. So everybody who gets to heaven will be a Sabbath keeper. Everybody. All right. Well, let's continue on real quick, because when we get down to verse 11, and they had a king over them, which was the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue was Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon. Now, this king is Othman. When it says he was over them, look, he's the first king to actually consolidate all the different segments of Islam, the little groups. You know, they always have little sects, different groups of variations of, even today, there's, you know, Islam is broken up into segments. I mean, major two types of belief. But nonetheless, Othman was the first one to bring them together and under rulership. But what's interesting here, if you go back to verse 10, it says to hurt them for how long? 5 months. Now we're talking, what kind of time frame? Is this literal? No, because contextually, it wouldn't make any sense. All the evidence admits to the fact, based on what you've read, it has to be understood prophetically. All right, so look with this now. Watch this. All right? So I'm going to erase this right here, because we've got to get a little space here. All right, look at this. 5 months. Biblically speaking, how many days are in a month? All right, so now you got 5 times 30 equals 150. Isn't that right? Now, that's 150 days, but we're speaking prophetically. Ezekiel 4:6, Numbers 14:34, and there's other verses we can use. So what does the day represent? Yes, so now we're talking 150-year period of time. Now that you have a specific time period, you've got to have a now very specific beginning and ending, all right? So we have 150 years. Question is when? When does it begin to hurt men for five months, all right? Now, when Othman consolidated all of the powers of Islam into one group, he then began an expedition heading towards the Eastern Roman of the Empire. And this is where you really begin to commence your time period. And this is specific. You're going to have to be, because I'm going to tell you what, the sixth one's tied into this one. And it opens the door to the seventh. So if you mess this up, you're going to have a lot of confusion as it follows down the line. All right, now look real quick. Let's look at this. On July the 27th of 1299, that's right, I'm glad to see our brethren have studied this. Praise the Lord. Because I'm amazed what's happened to us as a people. I really am. But nonetheless, what happened in July 27th of 1299? Well, this was the first time when Ottoman and the unification of Islam under all the sects, they actually invaded Nicomedia, the section, of course, of the Eastern Empire. It was on this date, exactly on that date that occurred. So now all you're doing is you're going to count down. And that's all you're doing. Once you lock this in, like any time prophecy, once you have the starting point, it's just adding. That's all you're doing. This is the beginning is the most difficult point of investigation and locking that certainty. And so you have Othman invading Nicomedia, the eastern part of the Roman Empire, as a consolidated unit of the Islamic regime. And you're counting down to July 27 of 1449, 150 years exactly. Well, that obviously is going to open the door to what? The sixth trumpet. Well, when we get to the sixth trumpet, and again, this is verses 12 to 21. This is all the sixth trumpet. And again, once more, just to reemphasize the point that I read earlier here in verse 13, we know that this has to take place, at least that period of the sixth trumpet, during the ministration of Jesus in the holy place. Isn't that right? So from 31 to 1844, it has to fall within that framework. Well, that's precisely what it does, because already we're down to 1449. Well, that's well into the framework of 31 to 1844. But there's another time prophecy given here, isn't there? Yes, it's and let me read it to you because we want to get this down. This time prophecy here, referring to the year, the month, the day. And he says this, let me read it to you. In verse 15, the four angels were loosed and were prepared for an hour, a day, a month, and a year for to slay a third part of the men. Now, again, let me just highlight a few points here. Four angels, an angel in prophecy, representing a messenger, someone who leads. In this particular case, a leader of Islam would be considered a sultan. Someone who had political power, not just political, but religious power. In other words, it somehow seemed to be that a sultan was like a priest and a king combination. Interesting, isn't it? A counterfeit of what? Well, it's a counterfeit of Jesus, isn't it? Priest and a king. But it's interesting you bring up about the Vatican, because that's precisely what the Pope claims, both to be a political and a religious leader, in the sense that he's supreme. So is the sultan. They claim that in their faith, their religious faith, that they are supreme politically and religiously. And in both Islam and Catholicism, they counterfeiting the true work of the Lord Jesus Christ in that capacity. In that capacity. Well, these are the four sultans or four leaders within the region of the river Euphrates that actually was the region in which these powers rose up. And I'm going to give them to you. It says Aleppo, Iconium, Damascus, and Baghdad. These are the four areas in which, and again, very important. Now, what's interesting about the sixth one? What's interesting about the sixth one? This is not necessarily a judgment on Eastern Rome per se. It's actually the demise of the Ottoman Empire that began the judgment through Muhammad long ago. In other words, again, you're reaping now what you've sown. And they've had their period. And it's interesting because when they invaded the East, there was a pocket of true believers, people like I mentioned, the Picards, the Paulines, and others who were faithful, loyal. They were direct disciples of the apostles. In other words, you could trace it out to the apostles. See, the Waldensians claim, and rightly so, direct descendants in terms of their faith now. I speak of their faith, not lineage, literally, but I speak spiritually, directly to the apostles. And that's true. They did have that faith. So did the Paulines and the Picards who came from the East, which some believe, as I say, are the forerunners, or those are the Waldensians. All right, well, look. This now period, so you have 1 year, you have a month, you have a day and an hour. So let's break this down. A year, biblically speaking, is how many days? 360. So you got, and then you have a month, there's 30. Then you have a day, well, that's only one. And then you have an hour. Yeah, it's 15 days. That's exactly what it comes down. If you break it down, I've actually done that. It's good to do it. I mean, because it convinces you. You're not taking somebody else's words. I've actually broken down the time prophecies, I mean, down to the minutiae. I want to know from me. I don't want to know because I read it out of a book. I actually calculate. I mean, I don't, that's me, but that, you know, some people don't want to do that, but whatever. I would recommend that you do it. Well, let's add this all up because we now know it's got to be 391 days or years. And 15 days, right? 15 days. All right. Well, look, once again, we have a time prophecy. What's the critical point of, the most critical point of a time prophecy? It's not the end, although that may be significant, but the end means nothing if you don't have a beginning. Well, the context of this prophecy, in the light of the fifth trumpet, admits to the fact that the only way you can actually start this 391-year prophecy in 15 days. The only way you can really get the anchoring of the starting point is you got to go back to the previous time prophecy. That's why the opening of the 150 years is critical. Because not only does it hinge on this 150-year prophecy, but it actually hinges on the 391 and 15-day year prophecy. And it locks in the end part of that, which is this date. And let's write this down now. So we've got now the 391 days, years, based on this date. So you're going to start on this. July 27 of 1449, and you're going to calculate now 391 years, 15 days, right? That's what you're going to do. Well, the question is, when does that end? The Ottoman Empire, and that's really what we're dealing with here, because that's the end of that empire reigning supremely over the eastern jurisdiction of the Roman Empire. All right, now look, it comes down to this, and this is the August the 11th of 1840. Now some say, oh, what's the significance of that? Well, one, the accuracy of what God said, the certainty of the Holy Bible. But let's read something here in closing, because we got to close up here. Look what it says here. Going to Revelation 11, look at verse 14. Speaking of the sixth trumpet, it says the second woe is past. All right, so the second woe being the sixth trumpet. Isn't that right? Because the last three are woe trumpets. So you got the second one that's past. So we're now past August 11, 1840. At least that's the framework of it, right? It says the second woe is past. Behold, the third woe cometh how? All right, now that's critical. Does it say immediately? No. See, the fifth and the sixth, because of the time frame, you have immediately, don't you? In terms of the dates, you've got to follow them one after the other. The 150 and then the 391, 15 days. That happens, it just follows exactly in that order. Now look, but the seventh one doesn't follow immediately. What is there then? Well, you've got August the 11th of 1840, right? There's there. What do you have? You have a little gap, don't we? Between the sixth and the seventh. But when is the seventh? That's the question. When is the seventh? Well, when we pick up our afternoon meeting, our last one, then we will commence exactly on that point. And we will show you precisely, I will show you precisely, this is the pinnacle point, this is the critical point of this prophecy, because all of this is bearing down to this one point. God has given us this truth. And somebody prayed that beautiful prayer, let us not be selfish in our faith. You know, I thought that was a beautiful, I love that. That was a really good thought to pray. We have a faith, brethren and sisters, a beautiful faith to give to this world. And may God help us to be faithful in that work.